This is Peter Lamborn Wilson, and he comes here every December, and he's going to talk on, well, he'll tell us more, but anarchist spiritualism. And
I always have to ask somebody to remind me how many years I've been doing this. Usually Anne Marie remembers.
I remember.
You remember?
December 1985.
Really? December 1985 was the first one of those. I think that practically makes it a. We should make it a national holiday. So it's called. I called it Chaos Day because the ancient Chinese used to celebrate on the winter solstice. The mythological figure, Mr. Hun Tun, from the Chuang Tzu book.
Could you speak up, please?
I'll try to project my voice. I know there's a lot of people here, and I usually don't have to talk this loud, so excuse me if I start to fade out. I'll do my best. Before I started, I just wanted to mention that since the last time I've seen all you folks, I've done something. I published these five pamphlets through Autonom Media. One of them is called Ayahuasca and Shamanism. It's about psychedelic drugs in country of Colombia. I interviewed Michael Taussig, the well-known anthropologist. Another one is called High in the Himalayas by Marilyn Stabline, which is a sort of hippie memoir of the 60s of India getting stoned with the Dalai Lama and stuff like that. Then Select Strange and Sacred Sites, The Ziggurat Guide to Western New York by Tom Metzger. That has Oneida and the Hill Cumorah and the Fox sisters who started spiritualism, all the mad and crazy things that went on in upstate New York in the 19th century. He tells you how to get to them and what there still is to see there. Then Overcoming Fitness by Robert Kochek is best title of them all, I think. It actually says exactly what it means. It's an attack on the Human Genome Project, basically. And then Hieroglyphica by Anonymous. Guess who? Okay, and they're for sale. These pamphlets are for sale. Jim, is it all right if I make the same offer that we made on Sunday? You can get all five. They're $5 each, but tonight we'll give you all five for $20 if you want to get them. Okay? Another thing I've been doing since the last time we met, the Fifth Estate, which as far as I know is the oldest continually published non-authoritarian periodical in North America. Okay? Started sometime in the 60s or early 70s. Is under new management, and they're no longer going to be coming out once every 2 years. They actually got four issues out this year, and I'm writing for them pretty regularly now. And in fact, I didn't expect that this article would be in print before tonight. This is the text that I meant to present to you tonight. It's actually in the current issue of Fifth Estate, which I imagine is available in St. Mark's bookstore, although I'm not 100% sure of that. And so if you want to read some other interesting articles on the subject of spiritual anarchism, they have a special supplement, including an article on Taoism by Max Cathard, on Buddhism by Gary Snyder, and a couple of other interesting pieces on spiritual anarchism. Okay, what is spiritual anarchism? I often feel that when I talk to, if I can say something like a traditional anarchist audience, that I'm going to be struggling against a body of feeling. Opinion, some of it informed and some not informed, which tends to lump together everything spiritual under the same aegis, in the same category as religion, as organized religion, and therefore a lot of traditional leftists in general, Marxists, anarchists, everybody who comes out of that 19th century dialectical and other types of materialism. And with good reason, of course, in the 19th century, when organized religion was still very strong and yet, you know, obviously beginning to decay and crumble, had been doing so already for a few hundred years, really. And so the idea of a struggle against religion made a lot of sense. Now, I don't know, one could still argue that that's true vis-a-vis organized religions, but I think that enough water has gone under the bridge of history that we can go back and take a look at some of the lost history of anarchism itself, which is by no means devoid of connections with movements, organizations, and individuals that we might very fairly use the word spiritual to describe. Some cases even religious, in the sense that even within organized religion, there have been elements of non-authoritarian and even anarchistic thought. And if I could give you one example, Ivan Illich, who just died a few days ago, in my mind is a serious spiritual anarchist who really actually never left the Catholic Church, although he had an incredibly bad time with various popes and especially Paul VI. But he never left the church. As far as I know, at least when I knew him, he said that he had never left the church. And yet, I think he's one of the more important anarchist thinkers of the 20th century. He's not usually included in that group because he didn't go around labeling himself an anarchist. But if you read his books, I think you'll see that they're of extreme value to the anti-authoritarian philosophical position. So, or another person who we had here in a forum years ago who just died, Harry Hay. Some people call him the founder of the American gay liberation movement, and he was certainly also one of the founders of the Radical Fairies, and believe that's why we had him here.
When was he here?
Oh gosh, I don't know, a long, long time ago.
When did he die?
Just a few days ago. Yeah, died just a few days ago at the age of like 99 or something. Very, very well on in life. He was already quite old when we met him here.
He turned on John Cage.
He turned on John Cage. Uh-huh. Okay, there's another claim to fame. So, that's a real claim to fame. I think what I'll do is, it's not a long article. It's really only 3 pages long. So I'll read each of these sections and then make a little comment on it. It's actually really sort of in the form of notes, and I called it Topics for Research, Spiritual Anarchism, Topics for Research. It begins with a great quote from William Blake, who's talking about the poet Cowper, a rather well-known early 19th century romantic poet. Cowper came to me and said, "Oh, that I were insane always. I will never rest. Can you not make me truly insane? I will never rest till I am so. Oh, that in the bosom of God I was hid. You retain health, Mr. Blake, and yet are as mad as any of us all, over us all, mad as a refuge from unbelief, from Bacon, Newton, and Locke." Cowper, by the way, spent a lot of time in institutions. Blake would have if he had ever, if they'd ever caught him. Blake, of course, is a kind of key figure for this discourse I'm about to, you know, try to present here. Blake, of course, a very spiritual man and at the same time a rigorous anti-authoritarian, was part of the mob that broke down Newgate Prison in the famous riot. He's a friend of Thomas Paine. Helped, according to legend, he helped Thomas Paine escape from England. If you haven't studied Blake, it would be probably the tastiest way to get into this topic. Anyway, I begin with Stone Age conservative. Stone Age conservatism, as the anarchist Paul Goodman called himself, a Neolithic conservative, by which he meant that he thought that everything since the Neolithic and the emergence of the state should be swept away, and that basically made him a backward-looking thinker in some ways. So as a joke, he called himself a Neolithic conservative. I've sometimes called myself a Paleolithic reactionary. So Stone Age conservatism, tribal, roughly egalitarian, proto-shamanic. I say that because shamanic is, in fact, a term in contemporary anthropology and is not necessarily strictly applicable to the Stone Age. Hunter-gatherers and gardeners, the gift economy, etc. I think that's, if you're familiar with the sort of fifth estate arguments about primitivism and against civilization, if you've then you know where I'm coming from here. Basically, without trying to make too much of a point of it, I think it's possible to say that for a million years or so, human beings lived in an essentially non-authoritarian society, and that it's really only in the last 6,000 years, since the fourth millennium, that with the emergence of the state at the end of the Neolithic and the beginning of the Middle Ages, that anywhere in the world there have been human beings who have not lived under an essentially non-authoritarian social situation. So comparing with the Stone Age to the Sumerian city-states, Sumer, the breakdown of the original unstriated human polity, the emergence of separation. I could go on about this. I've written quite a lot about it, actually, about the, the situation in Mesopotamia and the moment, so to speak, of the emergence, the appearance of the state in human history, which in some ways is actually also the beginning of history, because it was facilitated by the invention of writing around about the same time. And it's not until we have writing that we really have something we can call history, right? Before that, it's archaeology, anthropology, paleontology, but it's not history. So history, the state, writing, this trinity of forces emerges more or less between like 3100 BC, or 3400 BC, 3100 BC. So very quick emergence, remarkably quick in terms of the long duration of human existence. Only probably really all the major stuff happened within a century. At least that's the way I envision it. So really, here we would be justified in speaking of a revolution in the sense of an overturning, because what was overturned was essentially the village, peasant, the free peasant, small village, self-sufficient, non-monetary, non-hierarchical or non-separated society, which lasted up until about that time. And then because of irrigation, on the one hand, the invention of money, the invention of writing, a few key inventions like that, the emergence of the state was facilitated. It was not inevitable, in my view. There could have been a totally different human story. Nevertheless, that's what happened. That's what we're living with for the last 6,000 years. We've had civilization in every form of which, be it, you know, feudal, monarchical, so-called Republican, so-called Democratic, even so-called Communist, have all been essentially separated hierarchical states. So before you have tribal, non-authoritarian situations, after that magical or anti-magical moment in ancient Sumeria, you have states, hierarchies, and organized religions. Before that, you have something like shamanism. In other words, you have spiritual practitioners. The historian Eliade called them specialists in ecstasy, who are the doctors and in many ways the intellectuals of the tribal world. Who, however, have no inherent authority. And in fact, if they fail to heal people, often enough, they're often killed, or at least thrown out of their pretension to shamanistic office. So it's a kind of spirituality before the fact of organized religion. Call it shamanism if you like, even though that's a very loose term. Really, strictly speaking, should only be applied to Siberia. But in anthropology, it's become a very kind of catch-all term to mean any sort of a tribal medicine man or woman who is not part of an organized religion. And generally, we would consider them to be pre-literate or non-literate also. So we have that
we have the emergence of the state. At the same time, we have what I call the good old cause and the everlasting gospel, what Blake called Druidism. In fact, has always been the guise of our Stone Age shamanism and goddess paganism. So the everlasting gospel, this was a term that became popular in the 1640 English Civil War amongst the radical sectarians. The idea was that the written gospel, the Bible, as they had received it, was not the be-all and end-all of revelation and inspiration, that there was an everlasting gospel that belonged to the whole of human existence. And Blake and his fellow radicals at that time were very keen on the ancient Druids, with whatever degree of accuracy they had interpreted ancient Druidism as essentially as a non-authoritarian or liberatory form of spirituality. So a lot of free thinkers, anti-Christians, and even out-and-out atheists would have rallied to this sort of druidical cause, this good old cause and everlasting gospel that could be Christian, it could belong inside any religion or outside any religion. And so I see these two things as the protagonist-antagonist in the great 6,000-year drama of history. That on the one hand, you have the state, the hierarchy of separation, the ruling class, the expropriation of surplus labor, blah, blah, blah. On the other hand, you have a memory going back into the Stone Age, the continuing that's constantly reborn, constantly revived, constantly refreshed in the human community. Whether there are real links, historical links, is not so important. Always the same message is going to reemerge. Someone's going to think of it again. You know, whether they've been initiated by some other person who was initiated, who was initiated, who was initiated, and so on back to the Stone Age, is not really important. The tradition is there. It's, strictly speaking, a spiritual tradition. It's going to keep on reappearing because it's, in my view anyway, natural for human beings to want freedom. What we're involved in here is not something unnatural or contra-natural. It's natural for these ideas to reappear. The idea that there could be at least a rough egalitarianism or rough equality, the idea that you could have a society where no one was too much richer or more privileged than anybody else. These kind of ideas are always going to recur because they're natural. They belong to us as our bodies belong to us, as part of our physical and mental heritage as human beings. So all of that versus what I call the 6,000-year Illuminati con job, state religion, and the emergence of money as the sexuality of the dead. I've talked about this in previous years, so I really don't, it would take me too long to explain precisely what I mean here. Just get the feeling of it. Money is the sexuality of the dead. Benjamin Franklin said, money begets money. Money isn't alive. Money's dead. So money begets money. Well, that must be the sexuality of the dead. That's all I mean by that, really. Now, part two, Bronze Age. Now we come to the Bronze Age. Actually, there's a sort of a Copper Age that comes before it, the Chalcolithic. But essentially, the Bronze Age, you've got your basic war god paganism, Marduk, Ra in Egypt, the sun, the solar sun deity that becomes the heavenly version of the pharaoh. With the technology of metallurgy, this and the emergence of the state, the invention of writing and money, all these things come together to facilitate a temple religion, both in Mesopotamia and Egypt, in which probably the high priest, the former shaman who has now become a priest, takes over the role of the sole monarch. So the original monarchs are, in fact, probably priests. The Sumerian word lugal means both high priest and king. That's why we think that is the case. So the Bronze Age, then, of course, leads on. Once you've bitten on the temptation of metal, you're not going to stop with copper. It's very, you know, it bends. It's pretty, but it doesn't make good sword edges. So after copper comes bronze, which is a little sharper and easier to polish, keep polished, and then finally, of course, iron. The discovery of how to manipulate iron, how to make weapons and tools out of iron, this is what puts the final kibosh on the emergence of the state. Now the state is heavily armed,
weapons, with chariots, horse-driven chariots, and metal weapons. And war is no longer a matter of a few people going over the hill and stealing a few cattle and whooping it up and maybe somebody getting punched out. War is now a serious matter of enslaving entire populations and never letting them go. This makes a big difference. Primitive warfare and what I would call classical warfare are two very different things. Primitive warfare actually vociferates energies. It's centrifugal. There is no accumulation with primitive warfare. Classical warfare is exactly the opposite. It's accumulative and centrifugal. And it ends up with whole populations enslaved, and it ends up with the warriors keeping the booty and making it, as you might say, the historical foundation for the emergence of capital and capitalism. So against this, the Iron Age, and then you could see this leading on quite clearly to things like the imperial paganism of Rome, in which we no longer have a charming goddess presiding over a garden in which everyone is equally the gardener. Instead, we have war gods, Zeus, Marduk, so forth and so on. The patriarchal religion of oppression and of the justification of oppression, the ideological justification of oppression. So you might say, and I'm going to actually concentrate here on Christianity because, as I say, it's the religion a great many of us grew up with, and therefore it's the one we hate most. It's the one that hurt us most badly. It's the one that we personally have the most to blame for whatever we think is wrong with us in the world. So I would like to actually, rather than go off and talk about something exotic like Taoism, where I could make a very clear argument for anarchistic principles, I actually want to, you know, attack the much more difficult and dubious subject of Christianity itself and see if even there we can't find within it, so to speak, the seed of a dialectic of liberation or something like that. So you might say that the early church appears as a kind of dialectic of within a dialectic of resistance, especially in its more radical or mystical early forms, which among which I think we should probably include Mr. Jesus and his pals themselves as radicals. You know that there's a lot of argument about this, and you can have any Jesus you like. Jesus the, you know, army general to Jesus the mushroom. So why not Jesus the anarchist? It's people have thought of it before. It's not an original idea with me, believe me. Think of Jesus throwing the money lenders out of the temple. Right? This is a sort of paradigmatic moment.
Money changers.
Among whom, land lenders. The money men, throwing the money interests out of the great temple in Jerusalem. A paradigmatic moment for Christianity as the social gospel. Christianity is a form of resistance against the great beast of Revelation, the Roman Empire. I think it's clear that the great beast 666, which is referred to in the book of Revelation, really is meant to be the Roman Empire. And Christianity, therefore, is biblical Christianity, should be seen, at least in part, as, or at least in some manner, should be seen as an attack or a critique of imperial religion. And we could talk about the Roman cult of the unconquered son, who was identified with the emperor, eventually was identified with Jesus, so that the emperor could identify with Jesus, so that Constantine could essentially appropriate the church and turn it actually into the ideological force of the Roman Empire. We should be used to this kind of 180 degree flip in history, when an institution makes an ideological flip and actually starts doing the opposite of what it set out to do. Actually, the late Ivan Illich was the master of this, the analysis of this situation, that he called the paradoxical counterproductivity of monopolistic institutions. A bit of a socio-mouthful that means that when an institution gets a monopoly, it somehow flips 180 degrees and begins to produce the opposite of what it claimed to produce originally. So education makes you stupid, medicine makes you sick, transportation doesn't get you there, etc. These were the critiques that Illich made of modern institutions. We can see the same thing going on even in biblical times. Right away, we have both the gospel of the poor, the idea of Christianity as a religion for slaves who are resisting, albeit passively. And we have, on the other hand, the incursion of Greek mysticism, Greek Neoplatonic mysticism, into early Christian circles. So that we're getting a mix here, at least in certain circles, of what we might stretch a point and call a revolutionary stance towards society, combined with a fierce, otherworldly, even rather Gnostic dualist kind of mysticism. But let me make it straight that I'm not aligning myself with anything that I'm discussing here. You know, I'm not identifying with this, and I'm not willing to stand up and defend any of these groups or tendencies or movements against the critiques that might be brought to them, with, of course, our perfect hindsight, right? Our ability to look back on history as if we were the, the perfect avatars of evolutionary perfection, beyond which there will never be any further philosophical or intellectual development, and judge the past as if everyone up till now has just been stupid or ill-intentioned. So all I'm saying is, all I want to do here is to try to understand myself, and maybe to help you understand that things are more complicated than that. That the past, as well as Faulkner said, not only is the past not dead, not only is the past not past, it's not even dead. We all still live with the past in some way. It's like we live in an archaeological site under which there's layers and layers and layers. And somehow the miasmic atmospheres that drift up from those layers, maybe late at night, still influence our consciousness. Not to mention what we might actually be able to unearth, study, and read of quote-unquote real history. History as the study of what really happened. A very problematic epistemology, to be sure. I should mention the donation of Constantine, very, very important. It was a forged document attributed to Constantine, whereby the Roman emperor gives ultimate authority to the Pope. And so this is on the basis of this document. You probably remember from elementary school the Pope drawing the line down the globe and saying the Spanish can have all that and the Portuguese can have all that. It was on the basis of the donation of Constantine that such acts were carried out. It wasn't blown as a forgery until fairly late. I don't remember the date, but a great deal of damage was done in the name of this now forgotten document. It's conceivable that we could talk about this as the appropriation of Christianity by Rome itself, which I mentioned before, just as the Sumerian priest kings appropriated Neolithic spirituality as the suppressed content of the temple cults. What I mean by suppressed content in religion, why does religion work? Because it actually has a few tricks that are effective. It has a few ideas about consciousness, about how to change consciousness. It has a few practices of meditation and that actually improve your health and so forth and so on. This is actual content. Where does it come from? In my view, it all comes from shamanism or from outside organized religion. It's appropriated by religion. Its origins are suppressed, and the techniques are used to lure people into the Illuminati con job that is organized religion. Human beings are not so stupid as to be taken in by an utter con that doesn't offer anything, right? And this is a perspective that we would do well to try to remember in an age where, with perfect hindsight, we know all about the imperfections and stupidities of religion. You know, there was a time when religion was the thin edge of the wedge. If you read the Gospels from the point of view of anarchism, you'll think that you're reading, something about the Spanish Civil War. I mean, these were the rebels of their time. They were rebelling against what they saw as a very, very heavy oppressive imperial world.